I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Well, in all the hard and frightening talk of war and nuclear attack, how well do Washington and Pyongyang actually understand each other? Not well, writes the New Yorker's Evan Osnos after a recent visit to North Korea. He is with us. You can join us. What's your question from a top flight reporter just back from North Korea? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Lots of talk over the weekend and, of course, for weeks now about North Korea. Here was Secretary of State, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation with a message for the North Korean regime.
Our strategy has been to undertake this peaceful pressure campaign, we call it, enabled by the four no's. The four no's being that we do not seek regime change, we do not seek a regime collapse, we do not seek an accelerated reunification of the peninsula, and we do not seek a reason to send our forces north of the demilitarized zone.
All the no's, all the things the U.S. doesn't want to do, which should be, the Secretary of State indicating there, reassuring to North Korea. And here was Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., where the president is today, big speech tomorrow. She was yesterday on CNN's State of the Union and asked about North Korea. She said that the U.S. is trying all diplomatic means, then asked if she stood by President Trump's threat to unleash fire and fury on Pyongyang. She basically said yes, saying when diplomats stop talking, the generals step in.
I think that the fire and fury, while he said this is what we can do to North Korea, we wanted to be responsible and go through all diplomatic means to get their attention first. If that doesn't work, General Mattis will take care of it.
Well, that sounds simple, but of course it's not. Joining us now from Washington is Evan Osnos, staff writer for The New Yorker. In North Korea in late August, his letter from Pyongyang ran in last week's issue. It's called On the Brink, Could Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump Goad Each Other into Nuclear War? You can find a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Evan Osnos, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Your piece has been read all over the place, people talking about it like crazy, and you've been talking about it a lot. As you speak with Americans about the North Korean situation, are Americans asking the right questions? What are you being asked that you are happy for? What's missing, Evan?
Well, I think the question that comes up most urgently is a good question. And a lot of people have asked me whether Kim Jong-un is crazy. That is, I think, the thing that people are struggling to understand. Why would a leader of a country pursue a confrontation with the United States that could so obviously threaten his own regime's existence and his people's livelihood and their health and their future? And the answer is that he is, by all accounts, meaning according to the U.S. intelligence community, according to the national security community, and based on my own experiences in Seoul and Beijing and in Pyongyang over the course of the last month and a half, is that he's not crazy in the way that we think that. He's not mad. What he is pursuing a very confrontational approach to promoting what he regards as his own national interest. And first and foremost, in his mind, is protecting his regime's ability to defend against an American attack. So for him, that's number one, and that means being very, very aggressive.
You write about the risk of nuclear war. Is there some restraint that you can feel on both sides here that in the end would lead North Korea away from actually using these weapons and put severe constraints on the U.S. wanting to get into that realm, or are we really on the cliff's edge?
No, I think you make a crucial point, Tom. I actually think that we are not as close to the edge as it can feel to us every day when we flip on the TV or reading the latest headlines. The truth is that on both sides, there is a recognition of the profound, I mean, literally unique risks associated with the moment that we're talking about if you're actually talking about a nuclear exchange. And I'll give you a specific example. On the North Korean side, he will do these extremely provocative things. They'll threaten us with all kinds of rhetorical mayhem about breaking the windpipes of the Yankees and so on. But if you actually look at the conduct of Kim Jong-un's regime over the last few years, there is a tendency for them to threaten a lot and then to actually not do the most provocative thing. Specifically, they threatened to attack South Korean NGOs, non-government organizations that were that were pushing propaganda literature into North Korea. But when it came time to it, they didn't actually attack the NGOs. They attacked the balloons that come across the border, which is a very benign, kind of isolated way of expressing their rage. In the case of the United States, we call for fire and fury, as the president did. The idea that he would bring violence to North Korea, but he is, in the end, operating under the same principles of mutually assured destruction that have governed the nuclear arsenal since 1945. There is, and I, in my interviews with members of this administration, you know, the president is speaking the way that Donald Trump speaks, but when you talk to the people who are involved in this on a daily basis, down to the most granular detail, they are deeply aware of the risks that could that we're facing, and they are not cavalier about it. So I think it's useful to actually temper some of this public public fear with the reality that on both sides there are people who understand the grave risks.
What did you find most reassuring, if we can use that word, in Pyongyang, your time in Pyongyang, and what did you find most unnerving, Evan?
I'll start with the unnerving side, because there's a lot of that, and I think it's worth telling people about it because it's unusual. I mean, when you go anywhere in Pyongyang, there is a reminder of one kind or another of the possibility of war. So on billboards beside the street, or you'll see on billboards, you'll see pictures of missiles crashing into the U.S. Capitol. My host, which was the foreign ministry, took me down into the subway system in Pyongyang and said, this is where we would go in the event of a nuclear strike. It's designed to defend us. So that's unnerving, because it just seems like their level of fixation on the possibility of war is so profound. However, what's useful to remind ourselves, there's a domestic political purpose and a foreign relations purpose for them in promoting that message. They want to promote the idea for domestic purposes that the U.S. is an existential threat. That's how they kind of gain strength and maintain strength at home, keep people focused around a regime even when their lifestyles trail behind the rest of the world. And then they also, of course, want to project this very tough image to the world. The encouraging thing is that life goes on in North Korea. And I think this is the hardest part for people to picture from far away. It's such a closed and secretive and paranoid country. They don't let anybody in to see it very often. And as a result, we don't have much of a picture of it. But I can tell you that when you're there, you're not gripped by a sense that these are people in a suicidal, sort of mesmerized by a suicidal mission, the way that we have become accustomed to seeing in jihadist movements. And we've almost become used to the idea that there are people who see valor in suicide. And that's not North Korea. People there are watching smuggled South Korean film and television, and they are trying to imitate the styles that they see outside the country. And, you know, there's a black market in real estate where people are buying and selling apartments outside of state control. So there is this, in some ways, outside of the nuclear confrontation, there is an aspiration for life. And that's crucial. That's absolutely vital in understanding it.
Let's see, take a call or two for you, Evan, if I may. Jim in New York, Saratoga, New York. Jim, you're on the air with Evan Osnos.
Hi, Tom. I'm deeply concerned about the situation, mainly because of who we have as president now. And I noticed that I got on the Internet this morning, it was either CNN or MSNBC, reported that Russia and China were going to conduct joint naval maneuvers off the North Korean coast. And I'm wondering, is that designed to scare us off, or was it designed to intimidate North Korea?
That's interesting. I'm reading that same report here, Jim, from The Independent, that Russia and China have begun at this point big military drills less than 100 miles from the North Korean border. You've got Chinese warships in Peter the Great Bay just outside the Russian port of Vladivostok for joint naval exercises that will extend in the Sea of Okhotsk north of Japan. Evan, I don't know if that's beyond your strategic purview here, but who are they speaking to with these exercises?
Well, I don't know specifically, but I can tell you that my suspicion is that these are more intended to send a message to the United States than they are to North Korea, partly because China and Russia have been actually facilitating North Korea's ability to get around sanctions. They have been, as you know, they've been putting the brakes on efforts to put greater pressure on North Korea. Some of that is changing. They are allowing more pressure on the North Korean regime. But right now, it would be strategically inconsistent of them to be wanting to send too much of a threat to the North Korean government. They may be sending a modest threat. But ultimately, when China and Russia act together, and I've seen this over a number of years of living and working in Asia, it is generally intended to send a message to the United States, which is usually back off.
You don't have free range here. Artem in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on with Evan Osnos. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Evan, glad you don't think Kim Jong-un is crazy. I agree with you. To kind of add to your last caller, you know, isn't this a conversation about China, Russia, and the United States? Don't you think if we all lined our interests up and we got together, we can get North Korea to calm down, maybe give up their nuclear weapons? You know, I feel like we've been starving them for 50 years. What can we expect from a sovereign country? And don't they need their nationalistic pride like every other country?
If China, the U.S., and Russia all aligned their strategic interests, that's a big if. But we'll look at it, Artem. I appreciate your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Evan, that's asking for a lot, but you hear the plea.
Well, it's a key point, which is the role of China and Russia. I think the idea that we would get all three of our strategic interests aligned is probably a heavy lift. But in the short term, and I'm writing about this right now, as a matter of fact, China is evolving on this question. I mean, China is beginning to see the situation in slightly different terms than it did even a couple of years ago. As many people know, China and North Korea used to regard themselves as lashed together, allies that were in lockstep. The old phrase was that they were, in Chinese, as close as lips and teeth.
Yep.
And that's no longer the case. The truth is China now regards their North Korea's behavior as a real risk in the region. And for that reason, China is willing to put more pressure on North Korea. Not what the U.S. wants, but more pressure. And that's a meaningful change.
But toward what? I mean, after spending time in Pyongyang, do you believe that North Korea would give up its nuclear weapons program? And if not,
no.
Then how do we get to a sort of a safe-feeling, tolerable space here?
I don't believe they'll give up their nuclear program, and I think that's clear. My visit left absolutely no doubt of that, and it's confirmed by everybody who I've talked to who has substantive contact with North Korea and studies it in a serious way. So what are we going for? Well, the answer is it's going to be some form of de-escalation in the very short term and then containment in the long term. What that means is trying to get them to stop regarding their encounter with the United States as a trajectory towards war. That's the first step, meaning some form of diplomatic contact, some form of the lowest level of reassurance. Look, we're not going to get into a situation where the president of the United States is sitting down with Kim Jong-un. That's not going to happen for a long time. And the reason it's not going to happen is that it would require everything else has been achieved beforehand. That's sort of your, mm-hmm. That's your closing round.
Yep.
But what could happen is trying to get them to freeze their program, to stop testing, to agree to some terms under which they would continue to develop their program. That's the reasonable goal in order to build some sort of coexistence framework with them. Deterrence and containment, that's where we're headed at the moment.
And yet, your headline is all about risk, and the piece ends up really talking about brinkmanship. You write, you say, in 18 years of reporting, I've never felt as much uncertainty at the end of a project, a feeling that nobody, not the diplomats, the strategists, or the scholars who have devoted their lives to the subject, is able to describe with confidence how the other side thinks. That's kind of incredible. What's the biggest gap in comprehension or the dimensions of it that you see?
In some ways, both sides are dealing with a black box on the other. On the American side, very knowledgeable scholars in the government, analysts, people who have studied Korea for a very long time, and then some others who are national security generalists, but at the very highest levels, People like H.R. McMaster, who spoke to me for the piece, I mean, they are looking across at North Korea, and they don't know the answer to the most essential question, to the most basic question, which is, what does Kim Jong-un want? Does he really just want self-defense, or would he, in fact, use the nuclear arsenal to reinvade South Korea or to push the United States off the peninsula? That's a huge unknown. If you can't answer that question about your adversary, then you're dealing on very uncertain ground beneath your feet. And on the North Korean side, they're looking at Donald Trump, and they don't know the most basic question. They don't know the answer to the most basic question, which is, under what terms would he actually use nuclear weapons? With previous presidents, they've been confident that the president would not use nuclear weapons. But Donald Trump has deliberately, by his own description, sought to project unpredictability. And for that reason, they are very confused, partly because they see multiple voices coming out of Washington. They see that it's not just the president who talks, but sometimes the Secretary of State, sometimes Secretary of Defense, and oftentimes with different messages. So there is a gulf of incomprehension on both sides that surprised me. And I was a little bit uneasy about the questions that the North Koreans were asking me about the United States, because they suggested that there are a lot of big gaps in their awareness.
We just got half a minute. Donald Trump has indicated that that confusion or uncertainty can be used to advantage. Does it look that way to you?
No, I'm afraid. I think that uncertainty in this case is not helping his cause. It's making it harder. And sending a clear single message would be the best thing that the United States could do at this point.
Evan Osnos, back from Pyongyang and North Korea, and writing at length, very strikingly, in The New Yorker, on his experience and observations there. On the Brink is the headline. Evan Osnos with us from Washington. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're there for you. And right here every day. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.